Hi there, folks, and welcome to another episode of West Obsessed, where the writers and editors of High Country News talk about issues critical to the health of the American West. I'm Brian Calvert, the editor of High Country News, and I'm here in the studio with our collaboration partner, KVNF, in Paonia, Colorado. Today, we're going to talk about a really interesting story that kind of has to do with asylum seekers, immigration in a way, the incarceration economy, which is a weird booming economy in the United States and in the American West. And we're going to talk about California and sort of California as a mirage, I guess. To help me do that today in the studio, I have one of our correspondents, Sarah Torrey. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And our assistant editor, Paige Blankenbuehler. Hi, Paige.
Hi, Brian.
So, Sarah, you spent about a year or more working on this story. It's a story that takes place in what we call a prison town. The name of our story is Prison Town. Tell us a little bit about Adelanto, California.
Adelanto is a town of about a little over 30,000 people in the Mojave Desert. It's sort of 85-ish miles northeast of L.A., and it feels like a completely different world from coastal California. The landscape, the economy, it's sort of, it's really flat, it's really hot and bright, and the town itself is struggling economically, unlike the sort of coastal areas of California, which are booming. And it's very, it leans heavily Republican. It's sort of a isolated little pocket of red in an otherwise blue state.
Well, so basically Adelanto is one of those towns where you drive by it on the interstate and you're like, how is this here? What is this doing here? What is this town? I've driven past there a lot. My sister lives in Southern California.
If you go west of Las Vegas, you go through past the Mojave National Preserve, and then you keep, it's just like empty, empty desert. And then you sort of come to this, it's called the Apple Valley, and it's sort of a number of towns. There's Victorville, there's Hesperia, and Adelanto is sort of the least economically developed of these towns, and it's sort of away from the main Interstate 15, I guess. Has traditionally, as the town, as the mayor told me, has been in last place, sort of for all the indicators.
Sarah, how did Adelanto even sprout up? Like, what was their original purpose or their original economy?
It was back in the, early 1900s, it was agriculture. There was sort of a lot of orchards and fruit farms. And then actually the inventor of the hot point electrical iron, E.H. Richardson, came and thought he would develop a sort of master plan community for veterans coming back from World War II who had suffered respiratory illnesses and needed a, you know, the high desert air is really clean. And he thought that, you know, he could build this community there where they would come and live and sort of recuperate. But turns out no one wanted to live so far away in the middle of the desert. And they sort of instead congregated more in the coastal areas, the sort of typically the kind of places you think of when you think of California, like, you know, lush palm trees and ocean views. And turns out Adelanto didn't have any of that. And so it was thus unappealing. And so when that failed, agriculture sort of won out, and there was, and the town did okay during that time. There was, orchards, and it became known for its cider, I read. And then because of drought and dry years and the Mojave River shrinking, farming kind of became unviable, and a lot went out of business and turned over to, were replaced by, a lot of the orchards were replaced by poultry farms. And then those eventually died out too. And you had all this sort of empty, unused, out of production land. And that's how the army base ended up there in the 1940s.
So let me stop you there, because what's happening is we're basically in a classic California town. This is a town that started as a myth, with this, like, this idea of salubriousness, and people could come out there and be healthy. And then you had this agricultural idea, and basically irrigation from the agriculture, and the river went dry.
Yeah.
More or less, right? So then you have this town that's sort of like, well, now what are we going to do? And a World War I or World War II, an Air Force base comes in, trains pilots, and then you sort of get this military economy that goes. But then, like I think happened in a lot of Western communities, there's base realignment and closure, it's called. So they sort of closed, they closed down the base. And then what happened?
We should preface all this by saying the town's name is the City of Unlimited Possibilities. That is on the sign driving into the town. And Adelanto itself, the name is Spanish for like forward or progress. So there's all sorts of interesting, ironic literary parallels to that idea, just like within the town's identity. You get the sense being there and talking to people that there's all these people have had all these visions for what Adelanto can be and should be, and they've all failed, and they're just sort of like trying to reclaim this initial vision for the town. And an important part of its story is in 1970, you know, the economy is doing pretty well with the military and all the jobs that came from the base, and the town really wanted to incorporate. It hadn't before, and it ignored all these experts who said the tax base isn't big enough, you shouldn't do it. They did it anyway, and that a lot of its economic troubles can be traced back to that decision, because it just didn't have the revenue and tax base. But people thought, you know, we're not going to just be this military economy, we're going to build shopping malls and more people are going to move here, and it's going to be this big shining gleaming kind of city in the desert.
They're sort of like enviously eyeing their neighbor Rancho Cucamonga.
Yes, exactly.
to the south, which is a big sprawly, or, you know, Southern California, San Bernardino County, yeah, mall town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the mayor, the former mayor who was elected right after the financial crisis when the town was in really bad economic shape, she even admitted to me that was her vision. Was she'd grown up in Rancho Cucamonga, and sort of that was her vision for Adelanto, to turn it into the next Rancho Cucamonga. And so after the base closed down in the early 90s, the town really suffered. There had been a period of growth before that, with sort of some new homes being built, and the town had, you know, got some money, but then people just abandoned their homes. Property values plummeted. It was really hard. Lawns went dead. That's what, you know, the mayor told me. And
like basically, houses were closing, lawns were drying up. It just sort of looked like the desert's kind of reclaiming.
Town. And around this time, you have this new, not totally new, but this idea, you know, more and more prisons needed to get built, and where are we going to build those? Because America's incarceration rates had been soaring ever since, you know, the early 80s. Like during the 80s, these increasingly stringent drug laws and harsher sentencing policies had become popular with, you know, Nixon and then Reagan's focus on like the war on drugs and war on crime, and so there's a huge new demand for prisons, and so
this is nationwide,
and so had the belief that like prisons could nourish economic development. And so before the 80s, most prisons were actually built in metro areas because that's where most prisoners were located. But now you had this new sort of rural prison boom happening. And in California, you can see that in terms of where prisons were sited, a lot for economic reasons, because urban populations no longer, you know, thought these were really a good thing. And so you had, but rural communities were sort of desperate for the money, and they were sold on this promise of economic development. And in California, that's why you have so many, it's called Prison Alley, but it's this part of the Central Valley where a ton of new prisons were built in the 80s and 90s. And also outside of, in these sort of desert areas away from the coastlines, you had sort of outside of San Diego and LA in the desert, where around where Adelanto is in the high desert, and then also kind of through the Central Valley. And so Adelanto after the base closed, kind of saw this. They got the Adelanto Community Correctional Facility in 91.
How does a town make money by having prisons?
There's jobs that come. Adelanto, for instance, had a contract with the California Department of Corrections to house state inmates in this jail. So it gets, and that was a big part of its revenue. And that was a big part of why when that contract was going to go away, it was scrambling. So it was like, we need to replace this revenue. So when this private prison company offered to buy the facility, the GEO Group, and turn it into an immigrant detention facility, the mayor was like, great, that's, you know, we need that.
Yeah, so let's stop there for a second, because here you have a town that's reinventing itself over and over again. It's struggling. It's incorporated, so it needs to stay viable. And it turns to essentially making money from housing prisoners. And one of the ways it's going to do that is housing immigration detentions who are not necessarily prisoners. These are not people who have committed any crimes. What does the immigration incarceration economy look like today?
Yeah. Well, so this goes back to Ronald Reagan and the war on drugs that Sarah brought up in the 1980s. And that has always been linked to immigration because of the focus on illicit drug activity coming from our southern border. So you have this influx of Central Americans coming up and citizens from Mexico coming up through the border. So these ideas, and they've all existed under Reagan's war on drugs. Some of those acts that he passed in the 1980s really set the stage for this booming incarceration economy, which by extension fed into this immigration detention economy. So right now, immigration detention is the fastest growing form of incarceration in the United States, and it costs taxpayers $2 billion a year. And that's a huge number. And this is just one side of the incarceration economy. So just purely focused on immigrants. And what happens there, which Brian and Sarah can get into with some of the characters in Sarah's story, but there's an incentive to put people in these detention centers and fill these beds because economies in states and cities like Adelanto profit from them. So they imprison people who haven't committed any crimes except for crossing a border. Some of these people are refugees or are seeking asylum. So it creates this really dangerous feedback loop.
Right. So basically what you have is a culture that grew out of the drug wars, and then an economy that grew out of that. And then you had 9/11. And after 9/11, you have much more strict immigration laws. You have the Department of Homeland Security. You have Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, one of our scarier Orwellian acronyms these days. Mm-hmm. And under not just President Trump, who's obviously beefing up immigration detentions, mm-hmm. Even under Obama, you had a lot of growth of immigration incarceration. What we had in Adelanto, though, you get these facilities that are contracted by ICE. So anyone who's going to be possibly deported for one reason or another needs to be detained first. And that sort of brings us to this person that you met, Abdul Khan. And why don't you tell us his story a little bit? First of all, how did you get interested in Adelanto and his story in the first place? What made you even want to write this story?
I first got interested in it when I was, I think it was writing a story for High Country News over a year ago, and I learned about private prisons, and then I started researching kind of the prison economies that have grown up in so much of the rural West, and I started learning more about immigrant detention centers, and I don't think I even really knew before that there were special, as they're euphemistically called, detention centers. They're really prisons for this, you know, people who are caught up in immigration proceedings, which of course isn't, it's technically administrative detention. It's not criminal. And so, and that I think is lost on a lot of people and what, like, the true difference means. It means, like, these shouldn't be punitive. There shouldn't even be prisons. But often the system has grown so much that there's not even enough room to house all the immigrant detainees in special detention centers. They're just thrown into regular jails with the regular criminal population. And I guess what interests me was that there's this space where these rights that we take for granted simply don't exist, like the right to not be detained if you haven't committed
to run
a crime.
Free.
Yeah, and so what's even scarier, like the immigrant detention system, it's even more so than the regular prison system. It's almost all outsourced to private companies. I think 2/3 of immigrants are housed in privately operated beds, which to me like raised so many questions about, you know, a for-profit industry being sort of in charge of the system, which it really is. There's been tons of, you know, they've lobbied heavily. They claim they don't, but there's been lots of evidence linking their lobbying efforts to sort of the ramp up of this system, starting with like the bed quota, which Paige mentioned, where the government has to fund 34,000 beds for immigrant detention or have available that, you know, essentially fund them. And so obviously there's this built-in incentive to fill those up. And companies have now become really adept at sort of incorporating these mandatory minimums into their contracts. And then the government is thus, you know, under pressure to use those facilities. And, you know, that's why we have this industry that's just seeing incredible profits. And it's now sort of worming its way into all sorts of areas, from, you know, the ankle monitoring bracelets that detainees have to wear to, like, the private companies themselves are in charge of these. And
yeah, I think that's really important that this is an important story for the West and for people who come to the West. If you're just joining us, you're listening to West Obsessed. This is where the writers and editors of High Country News discuss issues critical to the American West. I'm Brian Calvert, the editor of High Country News. I'm here with one of our correspondents, Sarah Torrey, and our assistant editor, Paige Blankenbuehler. We're talking about immigration incarceration in a small town in California called Adelanto. I thought what was the most interesting in this story when you brought it to us was the fact that there, you had this town whose fate is tied to this strange booming economy of incarceration, where there are contracts, there are incentives. It's a basically capitalistic enterprise. It's a business. So a corporation wants to make a deal with a town so that the town will hold their facility. They'll pay a certain amount of money to the town. The federal government pays a certain amount of money to the company, and the company will hold their detainees for them. And so you have companies that are making millions and millions of dollars and a town that's making tens of thousands of dollars. And that to me seemed like a really strange system or machinery for someone to get caught up in, because they're not tried for anything. They don't have lawyers for anything. And what we found was one guy who had fled from
Ghana.
And had kept a journal and was willing to talk. And so I thought, well, that's a really interesting way to talk about how two things or entities, fates are intertwined. The fate of this dying agriculture town, this weird mirage dream in the desert that's sort of like fading away. And then I think you had a really nice description in your story of sort of the barbed wire fencing and the trash that's just flopping off of it from the old abandoned Air Force base that was there. And then you have very real people like mayors and city planners who are trying to keep this a good place to live. And the way they do that is they get into these contracts with people. Which brings us to Abdul. And so tell us a little bit about Abdul. What was his story?
His story was he was involved in the LGBT community in Ghana, where and homosexuality is illegal there. And he was working for two men who were gay, and a lot of rumors started. It's very intolerant towards gay people, and there were rumors that he too was gay. And he had a really he was living with his uncle at the time, and sort of hearing vague threats against his life. And then one night he saw men coming for him, And he got very scared and fled his home and went to his two friends, the only people really he trusted. He lived in this very sort of insular community. And they told him that the only place where he, you know, he had to leave.
He had to flee for his life.
Yeah, he had to flee for his life. The country wasn't safe. It's a very small country. And I guess this community that he's a part of, you know, they have like leaders in various towns and in the capital, Accra, which wasn't too far away. And so they just said that. And so they scraped together money for a plane ticket. He flies to Ecuador, which doesn't need a visa. And there's a lot of African and Asian migrants sort of now making this journey. And then they get there and they get connected to sort of this smuggling network that took them up to, he traveled with a bunch of other migrants up to the U.S. border. And
so basically he's in Ecuador and he makes his way up to the United States. He makes his way to Tijuana and gets to the border and asks for asylum. And then he gets detained. And that's where he enters the system.
Why did he want to come to the U.S.? Why not just stay in Ecuador?
Well, he didn't speak Spanish, for one, and he had always had, and this is what was so interesting to me, is that he had this idea of America as being this place where rights and freedom were protected, as like this sort of beacon of hope for what his life could be. And I think that's what drew me to his story, was just sort of his shock at getting to the United States and being, you know, detained in this place for over a year of his life without ever really having a proper, without having committed a crime, and all the things he sort of, the details that stuck in his mind, like the handcuffs, the lack of freedom, like the sort of horrible conditions inside this place, just for him were this, I guess, huge, almost slap in the face of what he had thought America was.
Yeah.
It was like he had this dream of, you know, saving his life and restarting his life in America, where, you know, he thought he would be protected, and then he instead finds himself in Adelanto.
Yeah, it's just like the people of Adelanto have this dreams too. This is a place where, sort of like the California desert, where dreams go to just dry up or something.
Yeah, and
yeah,
and
it was so difficult to read about what happens to Khan, because the fate of his future basically rested on how America viewed his request for asylum and whether or not he was truly a refugee. And you get into that in a really interesting way in your story. And maybe you can talk a little bit about that process and how he just had to wait and wait and wait in this system.
Yeah, so the current immigration case log is, you know, it's over 500,000 cases backlogged. And so with, as part of the laws ramping up immigrant detention back in the around 9/11, one of the things that was implemented was this idea, like mandatory detention for even asylum seekers. And so a lot of, you're immediately mandatorily detained if you're asylum seeker, even though you haven't crossed the border illegally, you're just, you know, came and did what you're supposed to, which is ask for protection. And so he was immediately put inside this place, and he could get a bond hearing after 6 months, but the bond that the judge imposed was so high he could never afford that. So it meant he would have to remain inside Adelanto while his case sort of went through. And
these are detention centers that have to keep a certain number of people in beds, or
yes,
they're going to have to pay for that number of, or basically the government's going to pay for a certain, a guaranteed number of people to stay in these prisons. Otherwise, the company won't contract with the government.
Yeah. And there are, I think, currently like over 44,000 asylum seekers like him being held in these places. And sometimes
they are safe
there,
in a way.
Oh. Yes, yes. That is one way of looking at
actually,
it.
Actually, that's not even true, because they go through there's a lot of psychological problems that happen as a result of that kind of incarceration and
right,
suicide.
And the past few months, actually, two people have died in the Adelanto facility. There's been many deaths. There's just, the medical care is often so substandard because this company is, the way they make money is cutting corners.
So often, they're not even being kept safe. That's not really asylum.
Yeah. And I think what's most, I think, troubling and I guess, the most hidden is the psychological trauma that people like Khan go through when they're in these places. And they, you don't know, you have no control of your life. You don't know when you're going to be let out. And that's a horrifying feeling, the idea that you might be locked up for years and years of your life. And so for him, when he lost his case, that was one reason why he didn't want to appeal. He just would rather go back, because the consequence of facing, you know, potential death or persecution back in Ghana was less bad than the idea of being indefinitely detained.
Right. So, in fact, what happens is he decides, you know what, I don't want to do this. And so there's some, like, bureaucratic paperwork that has to happen, but Ghana has to say they're going to take him back. And mm-hmm. that sort of never happens. And so he's sort of he's stuck. He's stuck in this middle ground. He can't he has to represent himself. He has to do all of his own research.
And he only gets an hour a day to the library from the detention center,
which doesn't have internet. So it's really impossible for him to gain access to any of the materials that he needs to present a good case for himself. And that's another problem with these rural detention centers, is they're so far away from legal aid, like, you know, pro bono lawyers or and access materials. So it ends up making it so hard for especially asylum seekers to, you know, put together a case for themselves. And that's, you know, been a big criticism leveled against these places. And of course, Trump has now pledged to, you know, he wants to build more of these, likely in struggling rural communities.
An executive order in January, he called for the expansion of detention centers for undocumented immigrants near the border. So
right, and not to conflate all of these stories, but essentially what you have are these, you have struggling Western rural towns, you have a system of corporate prisons who are making money with government contracts, and that looks like it's bound to expand. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're going to see a lot more stories like this. And I think that's something to watch across the rural West, where these economies are struggling.
And just one thing to add, because I think it's important, is some, you know, people have often told me, like, oh, well, you know, you can't just release them because they won't show up to, you know, there's a reason why we have to detain people in these proceedings, because they won't, how, you know, they'll just disappear. They won't, why, they have no incentive to show up for their court date. And actually, you know, experts that I've talked to, they say that actually people want to be legal. They don't want to just disappear into the shadows. And so if you release someone with an order to appear in court, the vast majority of people will show up. I think it's, the stats are between 70-80%. So yeah, there are some who don't, but 70-80% do. And so just purely thinking on the economics of these places, without considering the ethical issues, like, you know, is this the best use of, like, taxpayer money, when there's clearly no, you know, there's more humane and cost-effective ways to monitor people in immigration proceedings.
Right. And then we sort of, you know, famously quote Dostoevsky and, you know, Crime and Punishment, which is basically saying, you know, you can measure a society by its prisons, more or less. And what we say in this issue of the magazine is that we're far beyond Crime and Punishment here. We're, like, straight into capitalism and profit. But that's all we have time for today. You've been listening to West Obsessed, where the writers and editors of High Country News discuss the American West. We've been discussing incarceration and the immigration incarceration boom. Thank you so much, Sarah Torrey.
Thanks.
And thank you, Paige.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. If you want to learn more about the incarceration economy and how it affects the rural West, you can do that at our website at hcn.org. If you want to continue this conversation online, you can go to kvnf.org. I'm Brian Calvert for High Country News, and as always, thanks for listening.